you know, again, our culture, we fall for artists or public figures and we make assumptions about them. And then we discover that, you know, Joe, who makes great music, is a lousy human being. We're like, oh my God. It's like, well, the complexity of life is that Joe can make really good music and Joe could be a really awful person, but Joe is not an awful person in your life. So you have to kind of just make a decision there about how to manage that, because it's like, you know, if we want to cancel everybody that doesn't fit into our box, our world's going to be really, really small. Yeah. Like, there's not going to be anybody there except for us and three other people.
Yeah, and if you really think about it, canceling is just another form of ghosting, which is pretty prevalent in our culture. Hello and welcome back to Soft Spoken, a podcast. I am your host, Marfine Chan, and this is the 10th episode of the podcast. It's a milestone. Hooray, hooray. It is also part two of a special interview I had with my good friend, Shay Stewart Boulay, who is the founder of Black Girl in Maine, a blog on anti-racism that is based here in Maine, but is popular in across the country. And she is also the executive director of Community Change Incorporated, which is a Boston-based anti-racism group. And we're picking up off here on a conversation that Shay and I had on dating apps and dating as people of color. She's Black, I'm brown, well, Asian. And we both had and shared our experiences about being people of color on dating apps and in the dating world, especially in a state like Maine, which is one of the whitest and one of the oldest. And so here is the rest of our conversation. Enjoy. So in terms of dinner, whether to go on a date that involves coffee, dinner, or drinks, you know, I agree with you most of the way, but there are times where there's a Tinder profile, because let's be honest, Grindr is mostly a hookup app for gay men. But Tinder is where I found some luck on going on some dates. But that Tinder profile, the bar has to be really high. But there have been some Tinder profiles that and Tinder guys that I've gone on dates with who wowed me in terms of how they wrote their profile. You know, it wasn't over the top. It wasn't a college essay. It wasn't, you know, a huge love letter, but there was some mystery. There was some curiosity about who they are and who they're looking for. And it was artfully crafted. And that's usually what I'll say. I'll take them out to dinner. But that being said, though, I haven't been on a dinner date in years. So it's really hard to find those kinds of people online.
No, you definitely don't meet those people. I mean, I think it's always interesting because of my guy and I and how we met. And I had this friend who's younger. She's in her 30s. And she looked at his profile before we met. And she was like, I don't know. He's really good looking, but he looks a little bit like, excuse my French, fuck boy. And I'm like, why? She's like, well, he's got the suit on. And like, because he works in marketing, like, I still have the picture saved. I was like, it was like the perfect picture. You have blue eyes and you had a blue pinstripe suit on that like made your eyes with the tie pop. Like, I just couldn't help noticing, like, first off, we're in Maine. You don't see very many men with a suit on, and it's a good fitting suit in their profile. It was like everything else just worked. You were upfront and honest. I'm like, I don't know. I look at us and I'm like, I think it was just like universally, we were just the universal, like, y'all are just meant to meet. Because I'm like, it's weird. We never would have met if I hadn't decided to go younger, because I was trying to like get my carnal needs met. And then I ended up getting a lot more. But so many of the profiles, and I think on the het side, it's a little bit the same way. I mean, I have definitely noticed when I popped in recently just to look at what's out there, I'm like, these profiles have even less, less things going on. And you know, you had mentioned like different sites. It's interesting. People are surprised, women in particular. My most successful site, I would say, has always been Tinder.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the Hinge and Bumble sites, it's great that you can answer all these questions. You can do all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we have to meet. And so like my philosophy when I met my guy last year. In fact, I kind of named it like, you know, my great dating app adventure. I likened it to going to the thrift store. If you've ever been to a thrift store, you know that if you go to the thrift store when you have to find a thing, like say you have an event and you have to find a good shirt for that event, you're never going to find the shirt you need at the thrift store when you need it. If you go into a thrift store and you're just casually thrifting, you're like, I got 20, you know, I got some money, I'm just going to thrift. That's when you find the bargains. Now, admittedly, I know this sounds awful. You really approached meeting a man like going to the thrift store. Most of it's going to be trash. So I'm not going to get my hopes up. Like, I know it's just going to be like, oh, the stuff you buy from Goodwill, you get it home, you look at it in your house and you're like, why did I just buy this trash? But I feel like that approach worked. And so for me, Tinder was perfect. You know, my experience with like sites like OkCupid, all the ones where you can write a whole lot, those people seem less honest. I don't know. It just, for me, it's like, I prefer a quick paragraph. Let me look at you. If we match, let's have a conversation and then let's meet and see where it goes from there. I would actually say if they're writing whole essays and they sound too good to be true. Oh my God, I guess I should tell you this story. You can appreciate it. Speaking of essays. So the man that I dated before this current man was the beautiful indigenous man who's ex-military. Mm-hmm. Like several months after we had split up, he was back on the apps. He matched with a really good friend of mine who recognized him. But more importantly, he sent her a message. And she recognized it as exactly the same message he had sent me because I had shared it with her because it seemed so like perfect. And it was like a whole essay about everything. And it just seemed too good to be true.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I definitely have seen that before. And so does that make you feel a certain way? Like, how does that make you feel?
You know, what was really wild about that? That was in November of 21. I'll never forget it because he had reached out to me and was like, you know, I'd love to see you again. Maybe we could try to see if we could make it work. And so I was actually in Boston when that happened. And my friend, you know, hits me up and she's like, hey, isn't this blah? And I'm like, yeah. And so she sends me this message and I'm like, wait. And she didn't know that we were talking about possibly trying to like start again. And so I just sent it to him and was like, I think that our plans for this Friday are canceled. I didn't know that you were actually on the apps. And he turned it into this whole thing. I can't believe that you had a friend who would share that with you. I don't know. Like if you're actually trying to like work on things with me, maybe you shouldn't be on an app. It was the weirdest exchange ever. And it's also for me, that was also my line around, you know, you meet people on apps and you really don't know who they are. I will say that, you know, last year I did some things that in hindsight weren't really great. Also adding to our relationship issues as our relationship got serious. I did some background checks. I actually had two background checks ran on my dude.
Yeah.
Partly because I'm like, people could tell you anything.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of a documentary or something on Netflix. I think it had to do with Tinder, but the guy was basically convincing women that they were part of this cosmic reincarnation of a fantastic love story, and that, you know, he was in this battle with bad forces, and they needed to help him by giving him money, and essentially he was a gambler. I think I forget the name of it, but you know what I'm talking about. You know what movie that is, right?
Now I should say my human didn't do anything to alert my, you know, anything like that. But you know, having had a couple of really weird experiences with people on dating apps, it's sort of like you start to realize y'all are falling in love, and one of y'all has used the big L word. You're like, I really want to make sure I know who you are, and that's the I would say the downside to me, specifically being a public figure. It's hard, and I don't know if you have this, sometimes it's hard for us to talk openly about what it's like to be single and trying to meet people. Because I know in my circles, most of my people are partnered, so they don't know what it's like. And to me, it's like, okay, I'm older in life. I have a lot more to like, I just need to be aware of, like, if I'm bringing you to a work function, I need to know that I know who you are. I might have taken it a little too far. I actually used a family member in law enforcement to help with the second background check because I did the basic one myself. But I'm also really honest. I like fessed up. It was like, look, I did this thing and everything you told me was pretty much true. I may or may not have even called the ex-girlfriend in Florida to verify. I take things. Yeah. I'm hyper focused. It's like I want to know that I know. But then even that has made me think about the limitations of what's lost, kind of tying this back to like the beginning of question you asked me, what's lost in today's dating world? Well, the way we used to date, we used to meet people naturally. We had connections to them. You knew someone in your circle who knew that person. There was somebody, and I've said this to my guy, and like, it used to be you knew someone who could vouch for somebody. Like you moved back to Maine in your late 30s after not being here since your early 20s. We share no overlapping friend groups, though it turned in a weird twist of being a public person. His closest friend in Maine has been a follower of mine for years. And it took him months. His buddy was like, wait, Shay? Wait, you said you're seeing some lady named Shay who lives on Peaks Island. And his friend was like, you mean the blogger woman? And he was like, he had no idea how well known I was. But my point is that like, because you meet people on apps, you don't necessarily know who you're getting if you don't have any connection. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of connecting with someone and people ghost you or they like...
No, Shay, don't remind me.
I mean, I remember years ago, I met someone probably 2 years after my marriage ended, seemed really great. And then it was like, boom. And it's like, at this point now, 8 years in, I'm like, wait, before I get any kind of attachment, I need to know who you are as a person.
Yeah, and ghosting happens so easily on dating apps. All the dating apps, doesn't matter if you're straight or gay, it happens. And and not even on just on the apps, but also in real life dating, you know, where many people listening, me, probably you, we've had conversations with someone and we might have thought there was some chemistry, but then we keep talking and all of a sudden the other person just disappears, or maybe we've done it. And I'm definitely not blameless. There was a period of time in my 20s where I jumped on the whole bandwagon, you know, that now that I was gay and I was out, then I hit it under the phrase living my best life. And, you know, I was a little bit of a fuckboy and I'm not proud of it, but, you know, I would, you know, hook up and then ghost or not talk to them again. And then they would, you know, message me or like some posts and I would just sort of like, oh, it's them. And I think that's the whole culture of dehumanization in dating that has become prevalent, because to ghost someone to just, you know, kind of like an exit wound where, you know, you just go through like a bullet through their heart, through their bloodstream, and you just exit. You leave a exit wound. And I think that you have to intentionally think differently about the other person in order to just discard them and to get rid of them in your mind and the feelings and the brief things that you might have shared, instead of the hard thing of actually communicating and talking to the other person, you know, not just the cliches, not just like, oh, I just didn't feel the same way, or no, you know, we're just not a match, but actually talking it through is like, hey, you know, I like these things about you and we had a good date and I had some fun, but ultimately what I'm looking for is, you know, someone who is a little more interested in this or that, you know, like adults, although adults don't get this perfect by any means. But yeah, so I think there's a level of dehumanization in dating, and it's become sort of an epidemic. You know, it's so prevalent now.
Well, it didn't used to happen, partly because you had stronger social connections. I mean, think about it. if you met people through your shared social connections, if you just suddenly ghost somebody who, like, you go to the same whatever synagogue or you work in the same place, the potential for conflict is huge there. So, or, you know, cousin Jenny set you up with Ted. Like, you're not going to just ghost. You're going to have at least a conversation and go, hey, this isn't, I don't think it's a good fit. Now, that person could be mad, but you've respected them as a human being and like shown some respect and decency there. Well, in today's world where we all just sort of like secluded away, it only exists on my phone. It's so much easier to just be like, oh, I mean, I also think that there's a lot of emotional immaturity. Like, I feel like as our worlds and our lives have become more complicated, our ability to be mature and adult-like and decent has diminished. So people take the, well, it's too stressful for me to tell you I'm not digging you. Well, I know, having been ghosted or having been in a position where somebody kind of leaves you dangling and they don't call you for weeks or months and you don't know what's going on with them, it's a horrible feeling. You don't know, is this person dead? Are they alive? Like, what happened? You know, if someone tells you, like, this is not a match, thank you, but no thank you, you can be mad, but at least you're not sitting there wondering. Like, you know you've been dumped. But when someone doesn't have the decency to do that, it really speaks volumes about where they are in their life at that point. And it's typically not a good space. But we've also just, again, between social media as a whole and these apps, we've just made it so easy for us to lose our humanity. Because losing our humanity means that we do things that are that inconsiderate. Especially, you know, we're adults. Sex has many functions. It's fun. It feels great. It's, you know, it can be a symbol of love or procreation. But many people are in that middle ground there with it. But it's like, it's still intimacy, man. And if you're sharing intimacy with somebody, even if it's a one-time thing, don't you think they're owed at least some level of consideration? I mean, I always look at it this way. If you bump nasties with somebody, at least have the decency to tell them this doesn't work. And that's where the apps, like, really, I think, have screwed us up. Like, we just, there's a bit of shallowness in how we approach dating. And I mean, as someone who's been married twice, and I look at, you know, the women in my life when they're trying to date, and it's like, you've like lost your own sense of humanity in this process. And you probably, that's why you don't meet anybody. I mean, I've found it interesting that I have friends who've taken some of my old lady advice and have had better outcomes. You know, I just had a friend who just moved in with a man that she originally thought wasn't a good fit. And I was like, but you base that off a superficial, like, one moment thing. And then sure enough, they were able to build something up over a year. Plus, now they just moved in together.
Yeah. And I do want to say that you were pretty perceptive when you asked, when I shared the song I wrote with you via text, you asked, is there someone or is there a person? And, you know, this person, we're not a thing. We're just kind of going with the flow, feeling it out. And I met this person at the local bar, and it wasn't on the apps, which was surprising in a little way, because, you know, so much of our lives are centered around the dating apps, and at least for my generation. And it was just refreshing, you know, and this person's great. Again, we're not a thing, but we're feeling it out. But, you know, are dating apps actually doing anything?
I don't hear as many. I feel like I don't hear as many success stories. I feel like, you know, those who started with apps probably 10, 15 years ago, maybe even before 5 years ago, you hear like more success stories. But I definitely don't feel like they're very many success stories. I mean, I know that when I, you know, started my journey last year of getting back on the apps, and I would, you know, tweet about it. And I think I, you know, I wrote a blog post about it and had all of these people who were totally like, oh my God, like, I'm curious, especially for older women, where dating has its own, like, you know, its own realities. It's like, oh, if you're a 50-year-old woman, well, a 50-year-old man has his pick. He could go date a 25-year-old, a 50-year-old, like, he's literally wherever. 50-year-old women don't necessarily have that same pool. So I was really surprised at the level of involvement that, you know, people had. And partly it was like, well, because I've never met anybody on a dating app. Like, I would hear all these stories from women who would say, like, after the third or fourth date. So people started becoming really invested. By the time we hit like after 3 months, they're like, oh my God, y'all are still together. And as a result, I did get a little like I would share pictures of him. And that was before he realized how big Black Girl in Maine was. At first, he was like, oh, sure, like your family and friends. And then like one day he was just like, because he does digital like marketing and design. And he was like, you have like thousands of people follow you. Like my picture's out there for thousands of people. And so we ended up going some places last summer and fall where people would just walk up to him like they knew him. And he was like, please don't ever put my pic, take, please. Like, and so all of the pictures, someone's like, did y'all break up? I'm like, even before this break, I took the pictures down except for two. Because he was just like, it's really annoying. But I share that to say like, for so many people, they have such bad experiences that when you do hear someone has a good experience, it seems increasingly rare, like that people have good experiences on apps. I feel like I hear more increasingly that people, I think, are kind of going back to meeting if you have that ability to meet in person. I think of a friend of mine who met somebody recently, you know, the last 6 months. Man's never been on a dating app. He met this woman just kind of like by through their work. So I think that like people are realizing that with the pandemic, people realized they wanted real connections, if that makes sense. For people who were single, the pandemic wasn't a fun time. Like, especially that first year and a half, you couldn't really go out, couldn't get needs met. And I think that there might be a slow shifting away from the apps, like in terms of I want a genuine connection. So I'm not surprised to hear that you would meet somebody. The bars, you know what? Bars just like the coffee. It's the nighttime coffee shop.
You know, I wish there was a nighttime coffee shop.
There should be. You know, in Biddeford, Maine, there is Elements.
Wait, Elements? They're open at night?
They are. I think they're open till 9 or 10, and they do beer, wine, and coffee.
I did not know that. Maybe they should sponsor this podcast.
I know. I'm just, like, bringing them up. They also have one of the best chai lattes I've ever had, so.
I do like their setup, you know, their books and their coffee. I wish they would do live events, though, because I think I checked in a while ago about a book event, but they said no.
Well, they have started doing music again. So they are starting to do events there, and that's only very recent. But it is one of the few coffee shops that I'm aware of in Maine that has like the beer, wine, you know, so which I think is perfect for those who don't drink. If you're hanging out with a friend in the evening, you could actually get a coffee, a cappuccino while your friend has a beer, you get cheese plate. Like there should be more of that.
You know, well, it's interesting that people from other countries drink coffee late at night.
I mean, and I think the other piece around apps is that increasingly the older you get, there are less places to go to meet people. I mean, we don't have public, you know, that's another thing when you ask me about the difference in the world. I mean, when I was in my early 20s in Chicago, like late night coffee houses were a real thing. It's funny that we have Elements in Biddeford, but there were a number of places I knew in Chicago that were like, and I think most of those are gone now, like old school coffee houses that had a liquor license, but you could straight up get like a baguette and a cappuccino at 10 o'clock at night. You know, and the kind of place where you could sit. But I also think, again, our ability to meet people, phones are beautiful, but we're attached to them. It's a different world. I mean, you may not have had this experience, but I'm old enough to remember when somebody reading a book could spark a conversation. Well, you might be reading a book on your phone or listening to it, but like it doesn't start a conversation anymore in the way that it would if you had an actual physical book there. Like, oh my God, that's a great book. What do you think about it? So many of our ways, it's not just apps, it's technology. That's the biggest thing that I've noticed. Our ability to connect has shifted and technology is at the heart of it. On the one hand, it has given us the ability to really move the needle in regards to like social change. It's given us the ability to be aware of geopolitical situations around the world. Those are great, but it's also taken away some of our human ability to connect in real time. And we have to kind of figure out how exactly do we navigate this?
So we've focused a lot on dating apps and being on those dating apps as people of color. Now to shift gears more slightly, I think you've mentioned it and you've gone into it a little bit, but Maine is one of the whitest, one of the oldest states. And so give us your perspective as a Black woman. What is it like to be dating in general, whether that's on apps or in person, as a person of color? and give us that perspective you have of being in Maine.
I definitely feel that the landscape here is not what my friends, like I have single friends who live outside of New England. I'm be really specific. The pool is not better in Boston for a Black woman in my age. It's just not. And I've talked to Black women because my day job is based there. You know, what's the scene there? I mean, I've used the apps down there. It's pretty much the same. One, and this is going to be harsh, I find that most men of color who are straight in this part of this region of the country, a lot of them, they're not really looking for a Black woman. And it's fine. But compared to places like Chicago or the South, I mean, I can just tell you that it's easy for me to feel really invisible as a woman here. Like, I don't feel like I am perceived, like, obviously I'm a woman, but I'm seen as Shay. Like, I'm Black girl in Maine. I'm fierce. I do this fierce work. But it's such a different feeling. Like, I get off the plane in Nashville and they're like Black and brown men, and I feel like I'm being appreciated, if that makes any sense. I don't feel that way here. Like, when I'm in the South, like, men of color will speak to me, and it feels like you're on my level. We're having a whole conversation. Here, there's this sense of, it's hard to describe it, but I can describe it, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I feel like when a man notices me here, all he's thinking about is, man, I want some hot Black lady. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Like similar experience,
like they're not seeing me as a person. There's really no interest in seeing me. It's either.
Yeah,
I had this neighbor a few years ago, and I think he was a racist guy. And yet one night he was drunk. We had this bar on the island, and, you know, we ended up getting a golf cart. Like, I ended up on his golf cart. I don't know what, but he's real, you know, not a really good guy. And he just says to me, I've never been with a Black woman before. I feel like I want to be with a Black woman. Yeah. It's like people say things like that to me. When I say this, people are like, well, this is a one-off. And I'm like, no, it's not. Like, I think what was really hard for me, and this is really like, we have different, you know, lives, trajectories, but because I got married so young in life and my marriage ended when I was 42, I've had to learn over the last 8 years how to function in what I call this grown-up adult dating world. So, like, from 24, well, really 22, when I met my last husband, 22 to 42, I wasn't dating anybody. So the world changed, and I got, like, it's like a movie. I got dumped into it when I was 42. Last time I had been single, dating apps didn't exist. We met in real time, and I wasn't old. So 8 years ago at 42, I'm dumped into this market, and I've got to learn really fast, like, really learning that, like, it is not uncommon for people to say what they don't mean now. In fact, that is the norm. You know, I've had dating experiences, like, especially at the beginning, you know, my first attempts at dating when my marriage ended, that I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe how naive I was. You know, where it's like a kid. And I don't know if it was that way for you when you came out, maybe if it was a similar, like the first couple of men you were with, you like thought there was more of a connection or something than maybe there was. Cause in my case, I wasn't reading the room very well. So that's the other piece. When I was last single, I was in Chicago, very different world than being in Maine. So in Chicago, like, I would deal with all kinds of men. In Maine, they're all white. So now I've got to learn how to date in my 40s after, like, not dating since, like, I was 22. I got to learn to date in a white place. So it's been this, like, bam, bam, bam. Like, definitely the first few cats I dated after my marriage ended, in hindsight, they had no real interest in me. I will fully admit I fell for some okie doke, allowed myself to probably not be in the best space because I didn't understand, like, what was really going on. And it's like, I've had to learn and be able to pinpoint, oh, you one of those white boys who just got the fetish for the Black ladies. You know, where it's like, let's draw this conversation out a little bit more, where it's like, your attention's not the attention that I really want. You know, I've got this guy that I used to deal with before the pandemic. And, you know, he recently heard, oh, you're not with what's his face right now. And he's trying to slide back in. And he happens to be one of those people. But we sometimes connect as human beings. So I've tried to be like, you know, you do really racist shit. But the other day he sends me this text, and I was actually telling my kind of quasi ex this today. I'm like, blah, sent this text talking about how he misses my butt and my thighs. And it's like, that's the kind of stuff white dudes do. And they think that's sexy. So increasingly it makes me not interested in dating. Like, you know, I've shared multiple times in this interview, like I'm in this weird space. And it's funny because part of our taking this break was like, you know, if you need to do something while I get my life figured out, feel free to do that. And I'm like, today, I'm like, but I'm not really interested because one, I don't have the energy anymore. Like, I'm not young anymore. You know, I'm like, a woman gets to a certain age where you're like, you know what? I don't like Bob, but I'll live with Bob. Bob is battery operated boyfriend, for those who don't know. Just like, I'll take a Bob over dealing with a guy who I've got to, because I can't divorce who I am.
So you would be open to an AI boyfriend?
Possibly. But I would just say, you know, for me, race is really a real factor. And I think that the older I get, I would not say, you know, my daughter has come out as queer, and most of the young women that she's had a chance to connect with, because we're in Maine, they're all white. And I recently said to her, and she asked me this, well, you've been married to white guys and I don't understand it, but you say don't deal with white women. And I'm like, the complexities of it are so much more than I want to get into. But like, race does matter in relationships, that power and privilege piece, that dynamics, how are you actually being seen? And it's hard for me at this stage in my life to like unplug that. Like, I just can't be like, oh, you're just okay. I mean, in hindsight, you know, one of the first, like, we should say, hookups I had after I moved to this island was with someone who had been reading my work for years. Like, he was someone who knew my work from the Phoenix. Portland Phoenix, for folks listening, where I had a column for over 10 years. And this is an educated white man who was a former professor. And in the middle of the grown-up things happening, he says, oh my God, this is a dream come true.
Oh my gosh.
It burns. I should have, you know, in hindsight, I'm like, I kick myself for not just getting up. Like, that was such a like buzzkill. Like, that really sums up my experience.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, I think I've been pretty open about the fact that I plan on relocating in the next few years. And people are like, why would you go to the South? It's tiring. Like, we're already people of color in this very white state. You know, it's fine to learn to live with yourself. I mean, I will say that I'm at a place in my life that if, you know, we don't work on our stuff and get back together, I've accepted that. And I'm okay with that. Yes, I want us to work on our stuff and get back together, but I'm finally at peace with being alone. Like, I'm okay with that. At the same time, it's very natural to want human companionship. And I'm like, I'm just honest. Like, that's not going to probably happen here. Like, I just don't see it. I mean, it's interesting to me that the only person that I've ever managed to have a relationship with in my time of being divorced here is someone who's not from here. So someone who's like mindset is just very much not like a main mindset. It's, you know, even down to, it's just hard to have conversations because I feel like it's always through a racialized lens. And even if it's somebody who is more savvy about these things, there's still that place where you're like, I feel like you're really into that exoticism and I'm not here for that. And that's the part that's, it's hard to talk about. And it's even harder to talk about with your friends. I don't know if you have that experience. Like, you know, can you talk about it with your, you know, with just your homies? Like, oh my God, I went on a date with this guy and it was like, you know, he was totally into like, oh my God, you're Asian. You know, like for me, because all my friends are mostly married. Like, so I don't even have any place to park that when it happens.
Well, I think I already told you this, but, you know, I almost stayed in DC because the major reason was because it was so much more diverse, and not just because of it was for diversity's sake, but because I discovered so many, a whole new world, not to quote Aladdin, but a whole new world, a whole new pool of dating. It wasn't just a bland pudding of mostly white guys, but I dated and had fun with guys from all different backgrounds, and, you know, African backgrounds, Latino and Hispanic and Middle Eastern, and it was just so new to me, and I almost stayed in DC for that reason, because I knew my dating prospects were better, you know, the level that people were at in terms of the caliber, their education background and ambition and drive and professionalism and all those types of things that, you know, I can't necessarily find here. It's not that some Maine people don't have it, but it's in Maine, a lot of those people are already taken and married and you know, settled down. And so, you know, I often say that, you know, coming back to Maine came at a cost, and that was one of the costs, and a personal cost, I guess. And people asked me to come back to Maine because Maine, quote unquote, Maine needed more diversity. And I got that. Like, I understood that point, and I agree. Maine needs more diversity. But it came at a cost. And so I often think about, you know, what would life be, my love life specifically, how it would be different in places like DC, Houston, Atlanta, San Francisco, although that city's too expensive. And so, you know, though Houston and Atlanta actually seem pretty interesting.
Well, I will say Atlanta is one of the places on my list. Hearing you say that, so I am a bit older than you, and I've been here since I was for 21 years now. I do think there is a really high cost to your personal life. You know, I've been really vocal in writing about the fact that I was recently diagnosed with hypertension, which we believe is just sort of stress. And, you know, we know, I mean, the data points are really clear, particularly in Black-bodied people, like stress will, you know, lead to hypertension. And, you know, one of the interesting things, when I look at my health history, I knew I was already at a risk, though. Yeah. The work I do naturally puts me at like a risk of being constantly stressed out and having hypertension. But increasingly, and I talk about this with my therapist, the price of the work that I've done to help move the needle on race has come at a huge, extraordinarily huge personal cost and is now affecting my health. It has meant, you know, relationships, and not just dating relationships, because I wasn't born and raised here. I don't have deep connections to people. I mean, I have a handful of people I feel pretty close to, but compared to like in Chicago, I still have a handful of people who have been my friends since I was 10 years old. Like when I go home, I've got buddies I've known 40 years. I don't have that here. You know, Maine is a really insular place. It's very hard to move here when you're 30 or almost, I think, yeah, moved here at 29 and make friends, like those, that level of friendship. And, you know, while the work that I have done, and I've had some people, very prominent people of color who I'm very close to, tell me, like, you don't even know the impact of what you've done. Like, you opened up a door that nobody else had opened up. And now my work has helped normalize some of these conversations. I'm like, yeah, but at what cost? I mean, the cost was it had an impact on my marriage. It most certainly affected my parenting with my children. Yeah. It's now affecting my health. You know, before my dad died, we had a lot of harsh moments around my work and what the cost was. You know, the most haunting thing about my dad's death was the year before he died. We spent a lot of time arguing because him being older, and I think he knew he was not going to be long for the world. He really would say to me, I think you need to think about the work that you do. Like, yes, you make a difference, but what is the cost? Well, my dad, it'll be 3 years next month since my dad died. And it's like, now I understand the cost. The cost is my own personal, my own ability to be really happy, like to be fully happy. You know, even the relationship that I've had that has worked out, my work has been a factor. I mean, it's really hard to be this really super public person. And I mean, I go back to our first date, which was at Coffee by Design. At one of the Coffee by Designs, and it was on a Sunday morning, and like people were walking in, hey, and he didn't know who I was at the time, and he made a joke. He's like, "What is it? Are you like some sort of famous local celebrity person?" And I was like, "There's a story about that," but I didn't want to tell him any of that right away. Yeah. And so it was funny because
let me write a blog about
it. Right. And so it was funny when I did tell him, that's kind of what he was thinking. Oh, it's just some blog. I don't get it. Until like he realized you did this TEDx talk. There's like, you've spoken all over the country. Yeah, I have. Like, I don't just speak in New England. Like my work is known all over. And it's like, that's a huge cost. And it's, it does play a role in relationships. You know, it has, yeah. You know, as having now been able to have one sustained relationship, I can tell you, even still, there's a price to this. You know, for him, it was like, it kind of sucks sometimes. Like, I go places and people, you know, in our relationship, we would experience this where people would have this vision, I think, of what they would think my partner would be like. And he's not what most people, I think, who think they know me. Because that's a funny thing. My brother, as soon as he met him, was like, that man was custom made, tailor made for you. Like, he is the balance you have always needed. He is the person you need to, like, balance out your intensity. But again, people think they know us, so they have this idea of what they think your person should be. And my guy was so, you know, part of our nasty-ish break. That wasn't nasty. It was pain, emotionally nasty for me, was confronting the cost of my work. For him, it was, I don't like being in places with you and having people come up to me, and because they don't perceive me as being as good as you, I'm shit to them. And it's like, whoa. But then I would see it and it's like, oh man. So even when you find the person, what is the cost to your personal life? And increasingly, I'm like, I kind of look forward to being in a place where when I leave my house, people aren't going to recognize me. Yes, there are a lot of benefits. I will not lie. You know, having, you know, one of your dearest friends it be the speaker of the house is kind of a cool thing. You know, most of my good friends are all in local politics or state politics, which is fun. I mean, you know, it can be fun and it can look glamorous in pictures, but it's also like your friends, you know, they can't necessarily be there, you know, 11 o'clock at night when you're falling apart, you know, they're writing laws and things like that. Yeah, so it's like, again, what is the price? So I, you know, my advice would be consider leaving. I mean, yes, you were raised here and you've done a lot of great work, but we get to exist outside of our racialized identities. And I think in a place like Maine, there's such pressure put on people of color who are remotely vocal to, like, do the thing, that people forget that we are people with feelings and needs. Like, that we, you know, it really ties into what you opened up with and, you know, how you explain this podcast. And I wrote a piece some months ago about being a professional Black person. And I feel like anybody here in Maine who even speaks up remotely, like, now you're the professional person of color. Will you come to my event? Will you do the thing? Do people ever stop to consider what life is like for you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I think about having read your autobiography and just like the family, you know, you're raised with and what you have to navigate. Like, how many times do people really think about that for you? Outside of a, oh my God, you're so brave. Oh, you know, I don't know if you get that.
You're so resilient.
You're resilient. You're brave. Okay, but like, can somebody just be there when I'm falling apart?
Yeah, I totally get that. Like, I think both of us as public personas or public figures, you know, well, let me first say, for me, like, writing in my book about grace, empathy, resilience, perseverance, all these great quality traits, but, you know, people expect me to be this sort of Buddha type figure who's always zen and calm, but, you know, they, and so when they see me heated, like, or upset, you know, like on the Charter Commission, you know, they don't take it well.
No, people don't. I mean, you know, it's interesting you mentioned our time on the Charter Commission together. I mean, people, I think, had this idea about me that I'm like, but you lost something in translation. What I actually do for a living is I manage and run organizations. So that means I have to be measured and balanced in how I make decisions. And I can't let my personal feelings about a thing override rational thoughts. And it's like, again, you get put in a box. People don't see all of you. And it creates like your own internal conflict, or in the case of, you know, being on a Charter Commission, external conflict, people feeling betrayed because they made an assumption about you based off one data point about you and not the totality of you.
And I think that's definitely a good note to end on. You know, people need to go back to being human. And that includes treating other human beings like actual human beings. And when you put people on pedestals, or you put them in a box, or you paint this picture of them negatively or too positively, I guess, then you're dehumanizing them. Even if it's lifting them up and creating this super positive image, you're dehumanizing them, and you're either creating gods or devils or Satans out of them. And so, you know, my new life quest, I guess you can call it, is to bring healing to our politics and our ways of being. And I like to learn and listen to a lot of our indigenous friends who have such great wisdom about how to be and live and move through this world. And I think that, like the saying, you know, don't meet your heroes because you'll be disappointed.
That is so true. And I think a lot of people aren't really equipped to realize that. Like, yeah, the people, you can admire someone's work. And it's the same reason I tell anybody, you know, again, our culture, we fall for artists or public figures and we make assumptions about them. And then we discover that, you know, Joe, who makes great music, is a lousy human being. We're like, oh my God. It's like, well, the complexity of life is that Joe can make really good music and Joe could be a really awful person, but Joe is not an awful person in your life. So you have to kind of just make a decision there about how to manage that, because it's like, you know, if we want to cancel everybody that doesn't fit into our box, our world's going to be really, really small. Yeah. Like there's not going to be anybody there except for us and three other people.
Yeah. And if you really think about it, canceling is just another form of ghosting, which is pretty prevalent in our culture.
It is. It is. Well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed our time together.
And there you have it, the second part of my episode on dating apps and dating as people of color with special guest and my dear friend Shea Stewart Boulay. We had such a fun time talking that we talked for almost an hour and a half. So it turned into two episodes. And so if you enjoyed that episode, again, please like, subscribe, and follow on your favorite podcast app or platform. And find me on social media at Marfine Chan. And of course, support Shea Stewart Boulay on her Patreon or Venmo. Links are in the podcast episode description.